Scott?
Well, in principle, I'm more than 100% in agreement that there needs to be federations that link up as many people as possible that have a clear focus and, you know, can get things done. My questions with this federation, with any federation, is does the group have the resources and experience to do things on a federation level that aren't being done on a local level? Because I was also in Love and Rage for a little while, and part of my experience was, you know, I wasn't so involved in the endless rewritings of the program, but I was involved in, like, local organizing in the Twin Cities, and my impression was that, you know, there was our Twin Cities group, and there was people that we knew elsewhere and were friends with and, you know, had some theoretical affinity for, and that was good, but there just didn't seem to be anything that Love and Rage did as an organization as a whole that couldn't be done anyway on the local group level. And I mean, in the presentation, I'm kind of hearing the same thing. Like, there's the Baltimore group, sounds like it's doing really good work around that strike, but I'm just wondering, like, what was done, what did the rest of the federation do to support that organizing in Baltimore? And I guess in addition to that, like, if there's going to be a federation, what efforts are being made to, like, link up people outside of the obvious places, Boston, Baltimore, New York, whatever, get in touch with people that wouldn't otherwise have really anything else to plug into. So I'm just wondering, I guess, what kind of things does NEFAC expect to do, like, right now or in the very near future that can't be done on the local level anyway? And what kind of things are being offered to people that don't have access to the resources that we do in, like, the kind of larger movement places on the East Coast?
I mean, essentially, we're still a work in progress, right? I mean, there's all questions we have as well. I mean, on, you know, there's easy answers, like, you know, after Seattle, we, you know, coordinated between a number of collectives to collect money for, you know, arrested militants. And, you know, after Genoa, we, you know, had a call out within, like, 2 days to have, like, multiple protests at, you know, embassies all up and down the Northeast. I mean, stuff like that's relatively easy if you have, like, collectives, like, regional initiatives like that. As far as a publication, it's also, you know, a bunch of different, you know, we have this pool of writers now from a number of collectives, and people are, you know, working with each other to work on articles together and sort of skill share in that sense and share resources. You know, unfortunately, like most anarchists, we're poor, so it'd be great if we could, you know, we have taken up collections for, you know, it would have been great to take up collections for Roundhouse and really material support the work they were doing with that strike. During Quebec, we all put some money together, and, you know, we had an agitational sheet that we had 10,000 copies of that we passed out in the streets. You know, Clack and Casa had a lot of anti-capitalist sentiment, but there wasn't an overt anarchist politic in the street, really, you know, besides Kids in Black throwing shit around. But so, you know, for us, like, that was important to have, like, you know, something political and concrete and be able to pass it out. So, I mean, more and more we're trying to do more regional initiatives and also learn from each other. It's amazing, I mean, especially in Montreal, I think they have currently 300 anarchists through the legal system. Like, repression is, you know, it makes Eugene look like nothing. Like repression's a really big deal in Montreal. Boston, we also have repression. You know, like everybody, as the movement grows, we're going to have that. So it's good to learn from each other, you know, strategies, how people have dealt with that, security. You know, these are all things most people in NEFAC, seems like, or a good portion of, you know, have been active for at least a decade. You know, so they have the whole experiences of the 90s to draw from and learn from each other, not to mention, you know, individual study and whatever. And so it's mostly like sharing resources and skills and knowledge. Study groups we're focusing on more. The Quebec local is going to have a weekend-long study on patriarchy in Montreal in October. You know, they're hoping to get people from different federation, I mean, different collectives within the federation to have input in that, to be able to produce readers for people, for study guides. So little by little, it's coming up more. I mean, but we're definitely conscious of it. And I mean, we hope that, you know, our local organizing reinforces our regional organizing, vice versa. That's one of my criticisms of Love and Rage, is people I've knew that was in it. You know, it was like one person in a P.O. box was a local. I mean, we strive for active collectives that are active in their areas, and, you know, from that we hope to build a strong federation. That's about it. I don't know if that answers your question to you.
Yep, thanks.
Any other questions? Or anyone want to expand on that general question of how a federation can do something that the local couldn't do?
I'm just wondering what kind of, you're talking about infrastructure. I was just wondering what kind of infrastructure you know, or what kind of projects you're currently pursuing that are a lasting thing as opposed to sort of an ephemeral thing. And maybe also, if you could speak to any kind of organizing strategies that come from that, that will draw in people who aren't us, that aren't sort of privileged 20-something. For the most part, I think university-educated people, because I think we have a real problem with that, because that's what I see here mostly. And I want to see what you guys think about that.
Answer all the questions. I think we have a high number of people that aren't. I mean, I'm a high school dropout.
I was just in a session yesterday, though, and there was sort of there. Everybody put. I think it was one person out of about 20 that didn't have a university education in the tent. And I was sort of thinking about that all last night.
Well, I think we're pretty. I don't know what the word is.
This is not saying you guys are.
Oh, no, I know, but like, in terms of the head of federation, who's been interested and who has been coming to conferences, this I thought would be like one of the main issues we'd be talking about here was our real class struggle focus, and that we don't have a base of like upper middle class college educated kids. It's not our base at all. And though, I mean, it's not a purposeful thing, but I was grew more prepared here to be talking about those issues of class than that's, I think, the kind of confusion we've gotten from people in terms of like a reaction from us, like not understanding why we have this class struggle focus and in some way workerist, or, you know, I think it kind of more stems from this idea of sort of like you think of class struggle and you think of like older white guys in the industrial era or something, and that's furthest from what we our mind, and we feel like that class most encompasses like issues of that women face and people of color. You know.
So, Colin, like, what do you do concretely to get that kind of base, rather than a sort of organizing in the universities and having, you know, sort of privileged student groups?
I think what we most try to do is be as like principled as possible, like our politics, and not trying to recruit, and you know, reject like issues of what could be perceived as tokenism, and though while like keeping the issues of white supremacy and gender relations at the forefront, but I don't think we're out there to make what makes up the federation is not a preconceived and brought about that way.
The question is the class struggle focus, and how much do you think you can take that forward in, say, the North American environment where, you know, the average income is $40,000 a year, and how much, like, well, at least being working class does not imply that you're poor for a large section of the population, like, and do you think that's like, still relevant as far as, like, do you think you can make the class war focus relevant to, like, a larger section of the population than the 7% or 10%, 15% of people that are working and poor in North America?
Mark does. Well, first off, I'll just say one short thing, that our economic situation is temporal and it's going to change, and when it, the class divide will reemerge in a more apparent way. Go on.
I mean, you have to look at class as an objective condition. I mean, it's like basic Marxist theory, and it's also a world phenomenon. I mean, I don't want to identify with, you know, the North American bourgeoisie. I identify with the working class of the world, I mean, which is the majority, probably more than 80% of the world. And, you know, I mean, you have to look at it in those terms. And as a historical, I mean, objective condition, it, you know, capitalism's a chaotic system, right? We're in a period of economic affluence, which isn't going to last. I mean, if a revolutionary situation's ever to emerge in this country, it's going to be at a point of class polarization, you know, like there was in the 30s, you know, like there has been in other countries where revolutions have emerged.
The state becomes really good at managing those crises and devolving them onto the third world and stuff like that, so that I'm a little bit, like, thinking, okay, yeah, globalist class struggle is clearly an issue, but to say that the interests of the working class in North America are identical with the interests of the working class in the world makes me, like, wonder. I'm not convinced of that yet, I'm not sure how much of a mass movement you can get by focusing on the working class.
Can I just quickly respond? Actually, I think if you look at a lot of the neoliberal policies that have been coming through in the last decade, and especially in the last several years, what you see is really a polarization in the American class structure. Especially, like you mentioned, the average income. I mean, when you think about it, the average income is the total added, however you want to divide it, whether you want to do a median or modal. Yeah, and if you look at, like, the gap between the bottom 20 and the upper 20, I mean, it's staggering and it's growing. But in terms of displacing a lot of the structural problems of capitalism onto the third world, developing nations, whatever you want to call it, it seems that the neoliberal economic policies are changing that, and they're really, and granted, it's not really taking effect as much in the United States yet, but it's happening incrementally. And, you know, if these things become more and more, you know, as these things come into play, I think you're going to see an even greater class polarization in the United States because of sort of the demands of the world economic market and the demands of a neoliberal capitalist policy. And so what you're, you know, again, that gap's going to grow, and granted, maybe the average income will still sit around 40,000, but there's going to be even more people that are falling into that bottom economic percentile and even less people in the top. So there, you can build on solidarity based on that. It's something that's sort of coming to a head in the last few years.
I think also, I mean, without organizing on in a class sort of way, I mean, it's all political suicide. I mean, the right wing built a massive base in the 90s on class issues because the left wasn't there. I mean, you know, the Ku Klux Klan was out defending farms, you know, whereas the left, you know, they're, you know, the militia movement was on the rise around class issues, anti-government issues, right? I mean, this is, you know, there's a left-wing populist movement in these areas in the Midwest and, you know, around the turn of the century. And, you know, it was definitely to the left. And then suddenly by the 90s, you know, these same people are sort of attracted to the right because the left, you know, is focusing more on ecology. I mean, lifestyle issues. Like, I think that's a big problem. And, you know, I don't think you can just brush class away like that, because, you know, there's certainly other elements out there looking to exploit, you know.
I have about three people who want to speak. I got you, Blair and Dave. Green Hoodie.
Yeah, I think the class analysis is definitely important, and I'd like to commend especially the work you did in Quebec with the paper. However, that seems to be the, of all the recent tendencies within anarchism, the one which has had the most, I think, hard time actually phrasing its philosophy, its demands in a way which people want to read and aren't bored to death by the sort of Marxist terminology with a bit of anarcho-chocolate on top, is sort of working class, class struggle with anarchism, and it can be done. You know, I think the Class War magazine is fucking great, you know. Really struck home with a certain demographic at a certain time, and I feel and sort of what you guys have, you know, it'd be nice if that happened also. And what do you feel about trying to make your propaganda sort of readable by normal human beings? And also, what do you think about the sort of, you know, anarchism right now is in a very diverse phase with lots of different ideologies cropping up every few months. What do you guys feel about your relation to sort of, you know, other anarchists who may not necessarily be into NEFAC or, you know, think communism is a rather loaded word to fit in with your federation?
We hate permanentists.
Is that a racial statement? Don't accept individuals.
We Mark's have a joking. Lot of sort of, networks with people that, you know, aren't in our region and are struggling with the same things we are, trying to organize, and inevitably they have a different kind of personality than you know our federation does right now, and may have like a different focus, but we are like 100% like going to work in solidarity with like-minded anarchists, and I think that we don't see that the implementation of this federation and all our verbal baggage that comes with it is any way a limitation to like any kind of propaganda we'd want to put out at any time, or it's just a tool for organizing ourselves first. And I want to make it clear that we aren't trying to form a mass organization either. I think we brought that up. And, this is anti-mass. And so it doesn't, you know, preclude anyone, of course, from... A lot of us work in mass organizations, or progressive or left-wing ones. But to first organize ourselves and have a clear, like, concept of what we want and how, you know, get that practice in there of how to organize ourselves. Blair?
Okay. You were talking earlier about those turn-of-the-century movements that were left-wing, populist, largely economic-based. And I'm seeing this same tendency emerge time and time again where, you have this class-based movement, but they're still racist, they're still sexist, and they still have this class-based analysis, but that doesn't really adequately comprehend these forms of oppression that in fact predate capitalism. And I'm curious how you can expect to apprehend these issues with a primarily class-based analysis. And I think unless you can go beyond that, I mean, I don't know if there's agreement that these aren't just byproducts of capitalism, but if your only lens of looking at things is class, that your group's going to continue to be predominantly men and white. Is it a strategic argument like the ruckus collectives, or is it a theoretical point of like principle that like class is the end all be all, or is it that's how we choose to organize based on like some perceived more universal thing there that you can organize more easily around or something?
You want a coinage?
Well, it's also not accidental that an anarchist group should be formed, which is a class-based analysis. There's been going a lot of, compared especially to the 60s, when we could hardly you know, if you talked about workers, everybody's image of a worker was a white male worker with a, you know, fat beer belly and carrying a lunch pail. And, you know, the fact that workers were mostly women or people of color or young people was rather ignored. It's interesting that in the colleges today, there's been a whole movement towards support living wage campaigns in support of working people, towards the anti-sweatshop movement, becomes one of the major issues. This has become suddenly, even though these people are certainly not, people involved in the anti-sweatshop movement are not thinking in terms of Marxist categories, and yet they see it as a major issue, and it's been galvanizing people across the country, causing an alliance between the students and some of the poorest people of color in the country, the working people. It's also true, and we easily overlook it, we talk about the Black Bloc and everything, how there were major labor organized mobilizations at the mass demonstrations at in Seattle and Quebec and Genoa. Now, it's perfectly true that these were all kept within certain limits by the union bureaucracies, very conservative, and by, as well as limited views of the rank and file workers in these unions. And that's all true. People can point that out, and I'll say, yes, that is true. It's also true that these mass mobilizations of labor made an enormous impact on the country, and sort of were the basis on which the militancy of college students, mostly white young college students, made its, you know, immediate impact. And if there hadn't been the labor organization, and saw in the Washington demonstration after that, it made a big difference. Now, so the fact that an anarchist tendency is formed that has a labor and class struggle perspective is part of that. Now, it's also true that, and you're absolutely right, a class war conflict is not enough. That's true. And we've said that in all our documents and in our considerations, and that it's not that racism and sexism are not simply derived from class conflicts, gesund. But it's, and exactly how they derive, we haven't yet written the full program. We'll have our full, you know, document. And
that's 9 years.
Nine years. We're working on that. But the basic concept that we believe a fundamental conflict in society is a class conflict is something which has not been said for many years. And secondly, that there's also major conflicts around gender, race, and a number of other issues, and the ecology is a major issue, that we're pretty clear on. Okay.
So if I could just respond quickly to that. But when I read the Aims and Principles and like our collective in Seattle studied quite extensively, and also the Ruckus collective proposal on Love and Rage, it's like you can see that there's obvious class focus, but there's also these other things. But to me, looking at those things, when there's this, like you said, and also in the second issue of Northeastern Anarchists, like that a class analysis is like the lens you look at things through, that it's not going to be able to comprehend those other things. Because it's not the same dynamic. And that unless you have some different set of theoretical tools to apprehend those things, you're going to be theoretically hamstrung. You can part know, okay, these are different forms of oppression and domination, but how do they actually relate? And like, as far as the Aims and Principles go now, I don't see how they do relate, because it's a class-based analysis. It's not a critique of hierarchy in general, which has a generalized logic that's manifested through particulars, that we can lose control of our lives economically as well as based on gender, based on ethnicity, based on ableism, all these other things.
Somebody want to answer that? Do we want to go on with the discussion?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I guess part of the answer is that we've also recognized that the Aims and Principles aren't really reflecting that sort of analysis of a general form of hierarchy and a general form of oppression, which is why we're sort of transitioning out of the Aims and Principles into a more systematic analysis. I guess at this point I kind of want to speak for myself, not necessarily in terms of the Federation, but I guess as a member of the Federation, what I say is probably going to reflect as much as what anyone else says. at least for me, in terms of a class-based analysis, it's part of that sort of, it's both vision and strategy. To some extent, class can be an overarching thing that you can build unified movements out of. There was a quote I remember hearing from Coal Miner at the turn of the century, talking about how, you go down into the mine, we're black, we're white, we're Italian, Jewish, because, you know, there's tons of delineations on ethnicity. But we all come out of that mine the same color. You know, it's something that can unify people. And it can also divide. And part of class is what allows us to understand why those divisions are made, at least in terms of the current structure of our society. That's not to say that, you know, the class analysis will work in a future society, or we'll work in an analysis of a past society. This is just what we're dealing with right now. And again, it's not to say that all of these things necessarily stem from class. There's clearly social psychological origins to racism, sexism, homophobia, and every other form of oppression you can think of. So class becomes a strategy. It's a unifying point. It's sort of a step towards creating a society of equality. And in doing so, obviously, we have to be more principled. We have to be, our analysis has to be broader than just to say that class is the origin of form X of oppression, because that's just not going to work in the long term. I mean, you know, the Soviet example is a great example of, you know, sure, we can sort of get rid of class in the economic sense, but yet you're left with a lot of sexism, you're left with a lot of racism and ethnic oppression and every other type of bigotry and prejudice you can imagine, because the hierarchical analysis was never made.
Dave.
I'm going to change the subject from class. You mentioned dual power, and I was just curious what sort of alternative anarchist institutions you're building now, and if you're trying to make them permanent at all.
All right. One example of something that NFEC is somewhat affiliated with, and new members are working on from a different collective, is this Community for Libertarian Socialism. There's some information about it inside. It's basically like the attempt to purchase this very large, what used to be a SUNY campus in upstate New York, and it's got all of these wonderful dorms and buildings and everything, and I think the goal is to have some sort of space for organizations like NFAC or other collectives or whatever to have office space, to have archive space, to have space for lectures, study groups, schools like this, all sorts of things, and really establish that as a permanent space where we can attempt to show that we're working to create something, not just destroy something. I don't know if that's what you're talking about. I can't give you too many details. I just learned about it at the last conference we had, but there's a pamphlet inside that really goes into all the details about what they want to get out of the space. The Bodhicitta Collective in Boston is working on it pretty extensively. I don't know if anybody else has any other examples. Oh, yeah.
So you can talk with me if you want.
Yeah. Do you want to say anything about it?
Well, you pretty much summed it up pretty good.
All right.
And there's also the organizing within a collective model.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even outside of the Federation, we're trying to work with other groups in the region. I mean, our main interest is to see them form collectives, like, not just temporary for, like, the upcoming action, but, you know, permanent, semi-permanent collectives where people can, you know, build study groups where they can, you know, learn from each other. Like, and that, to me, is an important part of dual power. If we're going to build a society, you know, sort of on a federalist principle and, you know, on a collective model, I think it's an important first step. Also, in terms of, like, interventions, like, in our collectives, we're talking about housing. I mean, yeah, of course we want to, you know, we want the small-term bread and butter gains for people, like tenants and, you know, rent to come down. But, I mean, ultimately, you know, we want to expropriate the capitalists, right? So we want to, you know, possibly squats. I mean, the idea of, you know, permanent rent strike. I mean, these are things that we'll probably try and agitate for, and however much wishful thinking it is, I mean, that's where we want to get people thinking in terms of struggle, and not just to settle for, like, you know, $100 knocked off their rent, but to, you know, take possession of their building. I mean, how do you start that discussion? I mean, that's the sort of terms of power that we want to see in the long run.
Did you have something else, Dave?
So these are things that NEFAC specifically as a federation are trying to do?
Yeah. I have a couple other people before you. Scott, did you want to get back on, or are you all set?
Yeah, real quick. I guess other people probably already said these things. It's interesting, Mark, I think you're talking about the left-wing movements in particularly the rural U.S., and there was a real problem of racism at the time, and I think that's very different than now. And the reason, one of the main reasons why those, there are similar movements now, but they're identified with the right. But at the same time, I think that it's important for any anarchist to realize that, like, class issues are not necessarily poverty issues. Poverty issues are an extremely important part of that, and imperialist issues are also extremely important. But the, you know, class issues, it's the experience of working for someone else and having them have control over large areas of your life, and that is something that most people experience to a greater or lesser extent. And then from there you can get into other discussions about middle class experience versus working class experience. But you know, I just think that's really important, not to like be approaching the issue like poverty issues are the same as all class issues.
We have about 5 minutes left. I have 4 people left on stack. Does anybody else want to jump on before I close it?
I'll get off.
Sure?
Yeah.
Tamara.
This feels kind of like a boring question, but I'm going to ask it anyhow because it's important to me. It's kind of a follow-up to Blair's comments, and it also stems from a short conversation with Blake, who's not here, right? Last night. What's that? Oh, there you are. So it has to do with, like, the level of theoretical, like, unity that we're trying to create and lay out for our organizing on different levels, whether within our collectives or at a kind of federation or confederation level. And, like, there's a part of me that really wants to, that, like, we have looked at your documents and your stuff a lot and thought a lot about those, and I have lots of good feedback, but also concerned about kind of the sort of list of things and the disjointedness, and I know you guys have heard this all the time, and I don't want to, like, my question is, like, how much theoretical unity do you guys feel is necessary at the sort of federation or confederation level? Because there is that part of me that really wants it, that feels like we really need to be getting clear on, like how the systems of oppression that we're dealing with today have historically come to function together the way that they do and do right now. And you keep talking about the thick document. We're going to produce the thick document. So at what level does that happen? Because I can see us each. What's that?
That's a joke.
But I think it's important that we get clear on those things, and I don't know whether, like, those thick documents are going to look different for each of us, or whether we need to be doing that at our collective levels, or whether that's something that needs to happen at the sort of, I don't want to use hierarchical language, but at the federation or confederation level. You know? Do you understand my question?
I think so.
And there may be other people here who have thoughts. And the reason that I pointed to Blake was that he said, I don't think that's the kind of thing that should be happening at a federation or confederation level.
Writing up of the documents and
getting really clear and explicit on theory and theoretical unity and historicizing kind of our...
Well, for our example, experience, each group or collective that came together really had their own kind of idea of what they wanted to see in the documents, and a lot of people came with proposals and beforehand, and then it was a matter of like 2 or 3 days of coming together and like hashing all that out. And I don't think so much of it is not set in stone. It's like this sort of living thing. It's like being, it's like a kind of constant
discussions going on about certain things, and either individually or in our groups, you know, with our study groups, it's kind of one of the main reasons behind doing that, trying to do a patriarchy study group for a long time, is to really work through all these ideas and then get feedback from the other collectives that may be doing the same thing and kind of come to a common understanding or a point of unity or whatever you want to, whatever level we'd be working on it, and at least come to that common understanding together is sort of, it's like part of the big process. But we've had a lot of people have a lot of different ideas about unionism, and there's a lot of discussion on, you know, nationality, nationalism, and you know, where is there, is it a three-poled system of oppression, racism, gender issues, and class that all are kind of interlinked somehow, and how do are they really interlinked, and going into a lot of detail in that, and it's kind of the ongoing study that we're working on. I don't know if that answers your question.
Sure.
Matt?
You asked about alternative institutions, and I like Mark's response about how kind of inherent in what you're doing at the collective model, trying to kind of perpetuate that and help facilitate other people and individuals in Boston or wherever you're at to kind of also look at the collective model for organizing. And I understand that collective as a word might be kind of loaded and has lots of different ways in which a collective kind of functions. But the collective within Seattle, like, it's very much like a tight-knit group of people. They have a lot of political and philosophical coherence, but also a lot of emotional and social bond as well. And it's pretty exclusionary in that regard. It kind of sucks that there's probably a lot of people in the community that we have a lot in common with politically, but that aren't going to join our collective because they're not someone that we feel really comfortable with emotionally or socially. And I think that's really problematic in a lot of degrees, especially when trying to create a federation, that the collectives we have are going to exclude a lot of people because you can't just join a collective necessarily. If you move to a new town and you find these people who politically you want to work with, but like they're in a collective, it's pretty intimidating to be like, can I join your collective? It's like, no. And I think that just that model is kind of problematic, where it's really limiting to what we want to accomplish. And I understand you don't want to be a mass organization, but it's really intimidating. And personally, I have a friend who was in Boston who said the same thing, who really likes all the people in a lot of the collectives in Boston, but felt very intimidated because of the nature of a collective. And I'm attracted very much to the love and rage model of doing locals, in the sense that it's we're building these organizations in our communities based around political and theoretical ideas rather than social and personal and emotional ones. And obviously, it should be more than just a single person in a mailbox, but I'm curious if you've addressed that at all, the nature of collectives being a little exclusionary, or potentially being exclusionary. I understand not all collectives are closed, but...
Yeah.
I mean, it is a problem. We have people... I guess there's been subtle allusions to elitism, and... I mean, like you said, we're not a mass organization, so, I mean, our idea is to... Ideally, we'd like to work with people and help them form collectives, and which works sometimes. You know, there's going to be... Stas has formed another collective with people here too, so, you know, there's going to be three collectives in Boston affiliated with NEFAC. In Montreal, there's you know, there's a few, there's actually a lot of debate at the last conference, because one of the collectives is, it's a skinhead collective, it's Rash Montreal, the Red Anarchy Skinheads, and, you know, there's a lot of debate on, you know, well, you know, why would you identify skinheads, it's so exclusionary, like, you know, no one can join their collective that isn't a skinhead. But then the idea is that it's just one collective from Montreal. They're actually some of the most politically, like, solid people. You know, they're doing great work up in Montreal. They're kind of an anomaly in the culture. There was a lot of debate around it for good reason.
They're very working class.
They're very working class. They sure. But you know, I wouldn't want to join their collective. I'm happy to work with them one, you know, twice a year at a conference. Like, it's cool. Like, but there's also like a general union idea that they're trying up there too, mainly because one of the collectives, Manoir, kind of pulled away from activism and is more of a study group now, so they're not really active members in NEFAC anymore. But some of their members want to be, so they started this kind of general union idea, which I think some of the, you know, the RASH people can show up to, like people just interested in NEFAC. And I guess it's working really well. They meet once a month. It's sort of a model we want to try in Boston. BOFAC was an idea.
No.
But to meet with the both the existing collectives that are affiliated with NEFAC and also for individuals to be able to plug in. I still think the collective model is an important model, even for issues of security. I mean, it may be cliquish, but it's also important for security. But I do think there needs to be like larger structures, like citywide, and we're starting to explore that idea, mainly based on the Montreal model.
Yeah, I'm sort of interested in what you think of a non-denominational anarchist federation, which you clearly aren't. For example, I'm from the southeast of the United States, which has arguably the weakest infrastructure of anarchism in the United States, and in the fall, we're going to put on an anarchist tour, and after much debate, it was resolved that, you know, we'd have the Wobblies and Green Anarchy, you know, Crime Think Kids, and people from Black Autonomy and ARA. And we're going to try to put everyone together, which could lead to a complete bloodbath, but which could also, I was hoping, could lead to some sort of non-denominational anarchist network, organization, federation in the southeast, which currently, there's no really raging anarcho-communist. There's no, besides Onward, you know, social ecology isn't like, you know, making giant headway in the masses. So we sort of have to deal with what we're given and what people are interested in and who's actually willing to go out and speak on their positions. What do you think of the possibilities of forming sort of non-denominational anarchist federations, which may have, by nature, a fairly wide diversity of interest?
I think that, there's no reason why it couldn't work. I think that you would just be faced with different issues. Like, I feel like one of the things that's positive about NEFAC organizing and, like, regional movements, like putting out posters or putting out, like, the magazine or, like, any sort of informational propaganda stuff, is we kind of don't have to worry too much about what exactly is going to be written on it. Like, we kind of already have this general sense of what people are feeling about certain issues, whereas, just some of the groups that you gave, the group examples that you gave, I would feel like I don't really know what's going to be published under the name that I'm representing, and that would be one of my concerns. But, there's no reason why not to, and it could be a unifying tactic in a region where you're having trouble like getting kids together.
I think it also doesn't help out other tendencies. I don't agree with Crime Think. I don't agree with primitivists. I don't want to argue with them forever. I'd just rather them do their thing, and maybe they'll do something really successful with it, and that's great. I think they have some valuable points to what they're saying. It's just not what I want to be involved with. I would rather get beyond the first theoretical, roadblock, and actually get onto some organizing within a semi-solid framework. And if we meet down the road together, for a network, I think it's fine. As far as a federation, I think theoretical unity is, it goes back to the debate of platformism versus synthesism. The only successful synthesis model that I know of is in France, the FAF, they have a weekly magazine and, any number of bookshops and radio stations and like 3 dozen collectives involved. I don't know how they work. Something in their blood or in the water or something, but they're coming from all different tendencies, including...
It's the wine.
It's the wine, apparently. But other than that, I don't see any useful models. For me, I think it's more important to start small and, be kind of humble about your objectives rather than trying to include everybody. So I think that's just a big headache and you're not going to go very far. I'd rather see something start, with firm footing and build from there. That's just my idea. Not for a conference, it's fine if you want to just debate and stuff. I think that's useful as well. There's a lot to learn from each other, but when it actually gets time to go beyond theory into action and, strategy and vision and projects, I think you may want to consider limiting or at least, breaking it down a little bit into more specifics.
Yeah. That's all we have time for. And that's all the people who are on stack.
Wow.